Blog Talk Radio. Good morning. How you doing? And Kelly here. It's nice outside, and we've got one heck of an interesting story coming out of Washington, D.C., and internationally with Benjamin Netanyahu. I got some great stories for you today, and Neil Hooks is supposed to show up and talk about right to work, minimum wage, stuff like that. He's kind of an economically minded person. I don't go to all the party events. I don't try to know everybody in town, but I did go to the GOP thing last night. It was pretty good. Russell Allen gave a good speech. Like, I don't try to personally, be a mover shaker or anything, but anyway, 6:07. It is the 3rd of March, and it's good to go to stuff sometimes to meet people. I wouldn't want to presume the status of an important person, but I like to meet people. There was some good folk out at the GOP thing last night. If the Dems would invite me to their stuff, I would certainly try to attend that too, but that may not happen anytime soon. All right. So I gave some information that was highly sourced yesterday on the recall, which I don't even know if it's true now, because somebody had pointed out that this information could have come from Peter Goodman. So Peter Goodman had read a column that I didn't actually run into, but the column had said something along the lines that the recall was going to get tossed. It's after the fact, so it doesn't really matter in terms of getting signatures. But now I've been informed that Peter Goodman, if you know anything about this, or Peter, if you're listening, call in. But it was my understanding that it is in flux. They're doing the counting. And I called a couple of people. I got a hold of a couple of people yesterday that were involved and asked them. And they told me that the recall was... had not been decertified. They were in the middle of counting stuff. Sometimes you get information that's not quite right from high sources too. So I don't really like to pass on just rumors. I like to know something is true. I don't want to add to the problem, but since I had heard from a pretty highly connected person yesterday. Anyway, the main thing is that I think that the recall is still technically on, and I have not been able to raise Jeff Isbell, but I was able to get a hold of Pam Wolf, and she told me that that she had been a little bit under the weather, but that they were still working on it. So anyway, that's the status. As far as I know about that, look, it's either on or it's not on. All right, so we've got this stuff going on with Benjamin Netanyahu. It's extraordinary. That's some of the headlines. If you don't know who Benjamin Netanyahu is, you've been living under a rock. But Bibi Netanyahu is the Prime Minister of Israel, and he's a war hero, and he's a very smart guy, and he's somebody. He was involved in the raid on Entebbe. He has been involved in a couple of pretty high-level raids, and I think there's a difference between a person who has put their lives at risk in war. And this is not to denigrate President Obama or Bill Clinton or George W., but I think there is something special about an individual. I mean, George Sr. shot down in his plane and was in the water. I can't remember how long, but I think there's a qualitative difference between someone who has risked everything. And I would like to know, I'd like to see a study of people and their approach to war, leaders and their approach to war, leaders that have been in combat and those who haven't. And I think it would be pretty interesting to see that. All right, so I've got, let me get you a few headlines here. But what I want to tell you about is that there's a showdown between, and a very evil looking picture of Barack on the front of the Drudge Report, which obviously is saved only the darkest of times. But he looks like kind of a demon there. There is this showdown between between Obama and Bibi Netanyahu. And, I think I've got a little, I don't think I'm getting a cold, but I think there's a little bit of the Messiah Valley phlegm in my throat. So I think these trees and plants are waking up. They're fighting over Iran. And Netanyahu couldn't get an invitation. Now, I told you yesterday that the president had threatened Israel with shooting down the planes. Would he have had the cojones to do so? I don't know. But I don't remember the president threatening any Muslim nation to shoot down their planes. If you see what I mean, the game that the president is playing somewhat in the open, somewhat in the open and somewhat hidden, is a very dangerous game that I don't see has a positive outcome. I don't see America being technically better off after this president leaves. I see us being a lot more downtrodden. And it reminds me of the times of Jimmy Carter when there was a lot of self-doubt. If you have somebody who's leading you who is full of self-doubt or who is opposed to what you're about, number one, it's a question whether that person should be in leadership. But number two, what good is going to come out of that? You know, America is not exactly the mafia or the Soviet Union. So anyway, this guy, this great war hero, Bibi Netanyahu, comes over. He gets an invitation over. He comes over and he is, you know, I mean, he's fighting for the life of his country. If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it is very, very possible that they would use it against Israel. And I mean, does this president not care? How does that fit into the president's plans? If a country doesn't have a nuclear weapon, if they had a nuclear weapon, they would use it against one of our allies, one of the great civilizations in history. And if we could stop them without a great deal of effort, why wouldn't we? I mean, there's no positive spin to put on this. Even the Frankies of the world cannot say anything other than we got to support our boy Barack, you know. Frankie, get out of bed. Get on the phone. Defend your president. Anybody who has a defense of this policy, call up. In the meantime, Bibi Netanyahu is coming over here. It's an extraordinary speech. He's an extraordinary person. He's a throwback. He's Menachem Begin. He's Golda Meir. He's one of these great Israeli leaders that is spending his whole time trying to figure out how to save his country. Now, don't forget, the first day of Israel's existence, they were attacked by the Arabs, or they were attacked by the Muslim armies around them. So how would you like to be beat up the day you were born? You hear what I'm saying? All right, I'm going to do some classic country. I'm going to look at a different artist every day. So yesterday was Patsy Cline. Here's a little Hank Williams Sr. Can't help it if I'm still in love with you. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450. Call me. Call me if you see it differently. Call me if you see it the same. 523-1450. I've got my text with me. But we have got to get the message out there that America matters. We've got to get the message out there that we need to support our allies and stand up to our foes. This getting into bed with your enemy is just not working out. Anyway, Kelly O'Connell, 616, will be right back. KOBE.
We got a brand spanking new tune here that ain't never been sung on the air before, Louis. This is the first thing. Use a songwriter, sit over there and tell me what you think of this. Nobody's never heard this one but me and the record company. My next number, you're going to hear for long on record. One called I Can't Help It If I'm Still in Love with You. The day I passed you on the street and my heart fell at your feet, I can't help it if I'm still in love with you. There was another by your side, and he looked so satisfied, and I can't help it if I'm still in love with you.
It's Kelly here, and there is some headlines that I want to give you, and then I want to get back to what we're talking about, which is this thing with Netanyahu. But one of the headlines I want to tell you is that the president is talking about large unilateral tax hikes, totally unacceptable. It's like what's going on here in the county, which we got our hands full. You have three votes. where the people say we don't want a tax increase, and then the county says we're going to backdoor a $10 million, $12 million, $15 million tax increase. It's absolutely absurd to treat people that way. And if the president wanted to bring in his stuff, he could do it through Congress. This idea that he's a person who's so brilliant, so astute, so accomplished that he has transcended the Congress reminds me of Julius Caesar. I mean, this, you know, you're going to crown yourself. I just think it's a really bad sign. All right, here is Obama saying Netanyahu's speech is a distraction. Reuters TV.
President Obama sends a clear message to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Iran. I'm Jeff Mason at the White House, where I just sat down with President Barack Obama for an exclusive interview, focusing on Netanyahu's fears about a bad deal with Iran and nuclear talks led by the West. I started by asking President Obama about Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to Congress tomorrow, that it's happening without the White House's approval, and whether or not that has indeed been destructive to the relationship.
Your administration has described Prime Minister Netanyahu's plans to address Congress tomorrow on Iran as destructive. What damage has really been done?
I don't think it's permanently destructive. I think that it is a distraction from what should be our focus. And our focus should be, how do we stop Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, given Iran's rhetoric, given extraordinarily disruptive and dangerous activities of this regime in the region? It's understandable why Israel is very concerned about Iran. We are too.
I asked the president for his updated assessment of how likely it was that Iran would agree to a deal, and the president made it.
I mean, honestly, I don't know if you're like me, but I don't like to listen to him talk a lot of times, you know, because I feel like he's obscuring the truth. All right, here we goes. Ed Henry, who seems like a high school kid more and more every day, but Josh Earnest, his secretary, listen to this, doesn't think that the president's even going to watch the speech. Are you kidding me? One of our most important allies and the president is throwing a fit? This is how leadership is done. Bibi Netanyahu is standing up to the most powerful nation in history and saying, we want to survive. We want to do things in a way that'll help us survive. And the president is telling his secretary, tell everybody, I'm not even sure I'm going to watch. This is so typical of the Obama petulance. Check this out. Frankie, call in, defend him. Kathy, call in, defend him.
Given your comment, the Secretary Kerry's comment earlier today, that concern extends to the speech tomorrow by Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, what is true in any context? Is that the release of this information that was provided to Israel, our allies, in the context of regular, detailed, classified briefings, that releasing that information would betray the trust that exists between two allies. And that would be true even if the Israelis were to claim that they have obtained that information from somewhere else.
Will the president watch the speech tomorrow?
I haven't looked at the president's schedule for tomorrow. I doubt that he will spend his whole time watching the speech.
Is that so? I mean, the president always acts like, you know, it's like he's in high school. I mean, it's like the whole administration's in high school. They didn't do this the right way, and therefore I'm not even going to show up. I'm going to take my ball and go home. It's like grade school. All right, here's Bibi Netanyahu. The days when the Jewish people are passive in the face of threats to annihilate us, those days are over. They have to be over. Israel wants to survive. The Iranians want a nuclear missile. Don't you understand, folks? It is religious. That's why it's absurd to say that religion is not part of the, you know, understanding the modern world. It is at the core. Check this out.
That could threaten the survival of Israel. Iran is the foremost state sponsor of terrorism in the world. Look at that graph. Look at that map that you see on the wall. It shows Iran training, arming, dispatching terrorists on five continents. Iran envelops the entire world with its tentacles of terror. This is what Iran is doing now without nuclear weapons. Imagine what Iran would do with nuclear weapons. And this same Iran vows to annihilate Israel. If it develops nuclear weapons, it would have the means to achieve that goal. We must not let that happen. And as Prime Minister of Israel, I have a moral obligation to speak up in the face of these dangers while there's still time to avert them. For 2,000 years, my people, the Jewish people, were stateless, defenseless, voiceless. We were utterly powerless against our enemies who swore to destroy us. We suffered relentless persecution and horrific attacks. We could never speak in our own behalf, and we could not defend ourselves. Well, no more. No more. The days when the Jewish people are passive in the face of threats to annihilate us, those days are over.
All right, so you get the message there. It would be the same for us, you know? I mean, if America wasn't so powerful, they could not be so dilatory in the face, so indifferent. So, you know, the president kind of hemming and hawing and wringing his hands, and should we, how much of our forces should we commit to destroy ISIS, and then go around saying we're doing everything that we can. And I've got a phone call here. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Good morning. This is Antonio.
Antonio Bustamante, my not Reform Jewish, but Messianic Jewish friend. How you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks to the Mighty One.
All right. Give us your analysis.
I got a couple of comments, and then I have a question for you. I just wanted to thank God that Bibi Netanyahu is a great man, and he loves his people. He loves his country. May God bless him. And there's a law that God instituted. It's one of his promises. And he said that he would bless those that bless her, curse those that curse her. And that still applies today, just like gravity. And then this lying president that we have, he says he doesn't want to influence the political agenda in Israel. And my question to you is, didn't he go to Kenya or Africa or somewhere when somebody was running for some kind of office, and he was there walking with that person?
His cousin.
What? Oh, yeah, his cousin.
Odinga.
So,
Odinga.
Uh-huh. So what a liar he is. And again, his initials, BHO, boastful, haughty, and obnoxious. Have a good day. God bless you, and keep going forward with the truth.
Thanks, Antonio. You too. God bless you and your family.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. You don't have to take a religious look at this, but I am just, you know, here's one of the great mistakes in human history. It's becoming more prominent. It is what is called the fallacy of invincible ignorance. And invincible ignorance is a fallacy where you think that because you don't know about something, you're better than people who do. Now, we might claim that about pornography or something like that, but I mean, realistically speaking, I've known plenty of people in my life, at my times in the university and some of the intellectuals that I've known, who really thought that they were better, apples and oranges, better than other people who knew about religion. They didn't know anything about religion, and they were proud of it. They felt purified. To understand what is going on in the world right now, you have got to break it down, and you've got to look at the religious motivations of Iran. And they, Iranians, believe in the Al-Mahdi, which is basically the Muslim savior. This is the Shia, the small percentage. But that idea of the Mahdi has been adopted by the ISIS. So there, these two radical elements over there are motivated by the same idea. I've told you this before, but I think it bears repeating. They believe that that their savior has been hidden or in an occultation, like a cult, but a occultation, kind of like in suspended animation, waiting for his chance to return. He's going to come out. He's going to go to the Mecca and Medina. Mecca is the center place of the Muslim faith. Medina is the city of refuge. Then he's going to go over to Jerusalem. He's going to meet Jesus there, and Jesus is going to be obsequious. He's going to bow down to the Al-Mahdi, and then they're going to get together and start kicking some butt, and they're going to start killing all the people that are non-believers. And the non-believers, as you could well imagine, include Christians and Jews. So this is part of their public policy. Public policy meaning their official acts of the country are drenched in this religious worldview and what we call apocalypticism, the end of the world scenario. They're going to bring a better world. And they also have an antichrist in there, a one-eyed antichrist. It's pretty interesting. I should bring in the book and read you from their own literature. This is kind of fascinating account. But anyway, they're trying to start an apocalypse so they can bring peace to the world. But peace in Islam comes from dominating, totally dominating your enemies. Your enemies are people that don't believe in what you believe. And so anyway, it's worth thinking about. It's worth understanding. Here's a little bit more Hank Williams. Can't help it. This is like the first time this thing was performed in public. Hank Williams, brilliant songwriter and singer, and his father-in-law said $1 million voice and a 10-cent brain. He died at 29 in the back of a car of a drug overdose between concerts. Kelly O'Connell, it is KOBE 633, and we'll be right back. 523-1450 to call in, 805-6180 to text. Oh, hold on. I had to turn off the computer to cue my stuff up. Here we go.
I'm slowly stealing as I brush your arm and walk so close to you. And
It's Kelly here. Good morning to you. It's real nice to spend a little time together with you. It's 6:38 on KOBE. It's the third of the third month, 2015. All right. Another interesting story is that the person who put the portrait of Bill Clinton in the National Gallery has admitted that he put the shadow of the blue dress in the picture, Bill Clinton standing next to a fireplace, and he's, you know, obviously standing there looking into the towards the painter. To the left is the shadow of something. The guy had put a blue dress on a mannequin, and he painted the shadow of it, and he called Bill Clinton the greatest liar in history, something like that. I mean, it's really an extraordinary story. And, wow, I mean, you'd have to be upset. If you're Bill Clinton, you think that nobody's remembering this stuff, and then you turn around and the guy who Bill Clinton personally removed, or pardon me, personally chose to paint this painting, to do this portrait, turns around and it's really incredible. Pressure on National Portrait Gallery to remove, although the gallery itself said nobody. It is kind of interesting when you look at the picture that there's this shadow. There's no... It's a good-looking painting, you know. The guy's name is Nelson Shanks. And Nelson says, if you look at the left-hand side of it, there's a mantle in the Oval Office. I put a shadow coming into the painting, and it does two things, the painter said. It actually literally represents a shadow from a blue dress that I had on a mannequin that I had there while I was painting it, but not when he was there. It is also a bit of a metaphor in that it represents a shadow on the office he held or on him. And he says, there are times when I love to play all kinds of complicated games in painting, he told the newspaper. But I think this is one case when I needed to be fairly straightforward. I'll just try to paint the man, his intelligence, his amiability, and his stature. Maybe paint him fairly close to humor and try to get it just right. But he's also said that Bill Clinton is, and I want to find the quote here. I had to go to another article. This is from Philly.com. This guy is from around Philly, I think. And, well, anyway, I got a little clip from this thing, but I want to get back to BB in a second here, but I just thought you would find this kind of a remarkable story. Now, I will say one thing. If you look at the picture, there is nothing in the picture that you would say, well, picture is, you know, it's defaced, it's discredited or whatever. All that is in the picture is this shadow, but it is pretty interesting. There's no explicit reason why this shadow is in this painting. It's in the, for him to tell about it is pretty interesting, to be honest.
Nelson Shanks, not the monitor. Kalawinski.
Here's the clip.
Artist Nelson Shanks snuck a Monica Lewinsky reference into his Bill Clinton painting for the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. Shanks told the Philadelphia Daily News that he intentionally painted a shadow of a dress into the portrait to represent the shadow the Lewinsky scandal and subsequent impeachment left on Clinton's presidency. The reality is he's probably the most famous liar of all time, said Shanks, claiming Clinton was nervous while he posed for the painting in 2006. He and his administration did some very good things, of course, but I could never get this Monica thing completely out of my mind, and it is subtly incorporated in the painting.
You know, Clinton's just got to be infuriated by that. All right, so let's get back to this thing here with Bibi Netanyahu. Here is Ed Henry talking to Josh Earnest about the IAEA report, talking about the nuclear program in Iran. And this is on the eve of Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, coming over to give a speech that was not initiated by the president. So once again, you have to say the president is not a traditional leader. I can't imagine any other president this happening to. He is petulant. He takes things personally. He tries to get revenge. But the main thing is that everybody in the world can now see the dangerous direction he's led U.S. policy when it comes out that he told Bibi Netanyahu back in 2009 that if they tried to bomb this nuclear weapon, this nuclear production facility in Iran, that the United States would take down the planes. Now, what's safer, for the Israelis to bomb that or for the world to let the Iranians have a nuclear program? It's a very easy to answer question. Don't forget, the Israelis did us a favor when they went over to Iraq and bombed their weapons enrichment program and stopped their whole program and shut it down. What would Iraq have done with a nuclear weapon if they were willing to gas hundreds of thousands of their own people? All right, here is Josh Earnest.
Verifiable way confirmed that they eliminated their stockpile of highly enriched uranium.
Wait, on that one point, you're saying we verified that, right? The head of the IAEA today said, quote, the agency is not in a position to provide credible assurance about the absence of undeclared nuclear material and activities in Iran, and therefore to conclude that all nuclear material in Iran is for peaceful activities. That flies in the face of what you just said.
Well, Ed, what we have confirmed is that Iran has lived up to their agreement as a part of the joint plan of action. And that is confirmed based
on...
How
did you confirm that on your own? Because this is Iran's... This is the UN nuclear watchdog saying they haven't been able to verify that. So can you explain how has the U.S. verified that without the U.N.?
In the context of the joint plan of action, our international inspectors have gotten very important access to Iran, and essentially unprecedented access. And we have been able to confirm that they have complied with the joint plan of action. And this is critically important that before the joint plan of action was signed, even Prime Minister Netanyahu himself came out and said that it would be an historic mistake. But the fact is we've succeeded in rolling back Iran's nuclear program in the context of this agreement. We've succeeded in maintaining international pressure on Iran sufficient to compel them to come to the negotiating table and actually engage in serious negotiations with the international community to resolve once and for all the international community's concerns with their nuclear program. That is clearly in the best interest of the United States. It's clearly in the best interest of Israel. And it's why we would encourage people to not criticize these agreements before they're even signed.
And so to be clear, those were U.S. inspectors you're saying who got in? Because the U.N. says they haven't gotten in.
What I'm suggesting is that the international community has verified that Iran lived up to the... The international community has verified that Iran has lived up to the commitments that they made in the context of the joint plan of action.
How do you define international community when the head of the UN watchdog said today we haven't gotten it?
I haven't seen those specific comments, but we can get back to it.
He's on camera saying that.
Okay.
What a joke to stand there and just defy all logic. I mean, it's painful. I don't know where they get these nerds like this little a white nerd they kind of found. It's embarrassing to listen to this stuff. I've got another. Let's take a break here, Kelly, and we'll be right back. 523-1450 to call in.
I'm still in love with you. Can't help old time feeling. Suddenly I got that old time, and suddenly.
I live in New York. I'm 6 feet tall, and I live with two people who are 5'1". So I can't hear anything they're saying. I have no idea what's going on down there. But it's fine. I've always wanted to live alone. One of my roommates has a cat, and the cat threw up on my bed, and my...
It all started at the Central Perk when a runaway bride stormed into the place where she would work, and she would...
I live home with my parents? Yeah, it's temporary. Probably. A lot of people my age, they feel bad living at home, or they feel bad asking their parents for money. I don't. The only time I feel bad asking my parents for money is if they're already asleep. Right? You know? I'm like, wake up, mom and dad. I ordered pizza for you guys. Michael, it's 1 a.m. Okay, I'll eat it. I need $98. I ordered a lot of toppings. My mom was really worried I wouldn't get a job after college. She's like, Michael, you don't have a job. Why don't you just work at McDonald's? A, because I don't want to lose my eligibility for their Monopoly game. I live home with my parents.
Good morning, it's Kelly, 6:53. And we've got the story about Benjamin Netanyahu and... It's really extraordinary just to see what's going on here. And I mean, it is painful to watch someone that is representing America consistently do things that are either against our interest or totally unintelligible, or to fight with our allies while defending our enemies. The only way that Iran could ever be our buddy is if pitulated. They're total fanatics over there. It's a religious regime. The Ayatollah is the most powerful person in the country, and they're totally support Islamic terrorism. But we're making deals with them, and we're defying our allies. Here is Bibi Netanyahu again on this.
Clear weapons, lots of them. Ladies and gentlemen, Israel and the United States agree that Iran should not have nuclear weapons. But we disagree on the best way to prevent Iran from developing those weapons. Now, disagreements among allies are only natural from time to time, even among the closest of allies, because there are important differences between America and Israel. The United States of America is a large country, one of the largest. Israel is a small country, one of the smallest. America lives in one of the world's safest neighborhoods. Israel lives in the world's most dangerous neighborhood. America is the strongest power in the world, Israel is strong, but it's much more vulnerable. American leaders worry about the security of their country. Israeli leaders worry about the survival of their country. You know, I think that encapsulates the difference. I've been Prime Minister of Israel for 9 years. There's not a single day, not one day, that I didn't think about the survival of my country and the actions that I take to ensure that survival. Not one day.
And can the president say that? You know, Iraq attacked ISIS, and the State Department admitted they didn't see it coming. How are we so... I mean, we built the Iraqi army. We still have advisors over there. How do we not know that they're about to attack ISIS? It's just the stuff that comes out of this, you know, like the president saying that he doesn't know about things until he sees them on TV. I mean, whether that's true or not is just one of the most incredible things I've ever heard a president claim. All right, so here's a little clip for you millennials out living at home. Mike Palaszczuk, David Letterman.
I live home with my parents. Yeah, it's temporary, probably. A lot of people my age, they feel bad living at home, or they feel bad asking their parents for money. I don't. The only time I feel bad asking my parents for money is if they're already asleep. Right? You know? I'm like, wake up, Mom and Dad. I ordered pizza for you guys. I'm like, oh, it's 1 a.m. Okay, I'll eat it. I need $98. I ordered a lot of toppings. My mom was really worried I wouldn't get a job after college. She's like, Michael, you don't have a job. Why don't you just work at McDonald's? A, because I don't want to lose my eligibility for their Monopoly game. I remember when I first moved home, some of my friends were like, they didn't want me to, they're like, Michael, you should move out of your parents' house and you should move to Canada. I was like, I'm never moving to Canada. Their book prices are outrageous. Ooh, we got universal health care. Yeah, but look at all the money you spent on a Harry Potter hardback.
All right, folks, thanks for tuning into the first hour. I've got Neil Hooks coming, supposedly. He's working a night schedule these days, so this assumes that he didn't fall asleep. We got a real mess on our hands with Israel and, you know, the Middle East over there. And Krauthammer is saying that they don't need us, we need them. Here's a little Hank Williams to take you out, and I'll see you back on the break of the hour.
Then suddenly I got that old time feeling, and I can't help it if I'm still in love with you.
Snow in New Mexico has its challenges, but with our winter weather app, you can not only get my forecast, you can get live radar, which you can navigate yourself.
Here.
You can also
it
get detailed long-range forecast
and,
as well.
I do have Neil Hooks in the studio, but I wanted to just give you a little bit of news about this walkout. I saw some of the students outside of the Performing Arts High School. I think that's what it is over in off of Alameda. But here is from KRQE on the walkout, the testing walkout.
New PARC exam, a standardized test that's going to be used to evaluate students and teachers. Tonight, we took their concerns to the state's education secretary. News 13's Lizzie Mitri is live at Atrisco Heritage Academy High School with what she had to say. Lizzie?
Jessica, students walking out of class here were met by students from two other high schools for one of the biggest protests of the day. But the education secretary tells me these students missed out on a good opportunity. Students at Atrisco Heritage Academy High School, South Valley Academy, and Rio Grande High School protested here, while others from all over Albuquerque,
Hornets say what? No, Hornets say what?
No, even Rio Rancho and Las Cruces walked out on the PARC exam. It's the new standardized test for 3rd through 11th graders that will be used to evaluate students and their teachers.
What's happening now is that teachers are afraid that their evaluation is going to be so low that they need to start teaching directly to the test. And what that's going to do is that's going to lead kids to stop wanting to come to school because of a dull curriculum.
The most thing that we're scared about losing is like losing the fluidity in our classrooms and losing that teacher-student relationship that we have that teaches to all learning styles and not just the one that is catered to by this test.
We took their concerns to the education secretary.
More than 1,000 students walked out in schools from Albuquerque to Las Cruces. What are you thinking when you see this?
What we saw today was about 48,000 students successfully started taking their assessment. So when I put this in perspective, I'm proud of our teachers, school leaders, and students who stood up for a great challenge.
We asked again about the students not taking the test today.
After the assessment window, I will meet with students, but right now is an important time to focus and make sure that we're in the classroom and taking on this challenge and learning from it.
Here in Albuquerque alone, APS tells us about 1,000 high school students walked out today. They say more than 1,700 elementary, middle, and high school students opted out of taking the PARC test. Back to you.
All right. Thank you, Lizzie. Students protesting during class time will get an unexcused absence. If they were supposed to be testing, they'll get a zero on that portion of the exam.
All right. So that was happening here locally. And I stopped by one of the protests and said, who's your leader? And there was no leader. They were just hanging around outside smoking cigarettes, exchanging war stories, I guess, of how hard it is to walk in the rain. And
what kids don't want to take the opportunity to miss out on a test? So I think the vast majority of these kids probably have no idea what they're really protesting. They're just getting out of school.
Yeah, so anyway, we got Neil Hooks here, and Neil Hooks, well, here's the thing, Neil, and I think there's a couple of things that are driving the kind of, I would say not necessarily fear, but this lack of embracing this testing is, number one, people want their kids to learn as part of the, you know, this Western experience, the liberal arts tradition. They learn, have a broad knowledge, and not be trained to just pass a test, number one. And number two, people are afraid that the Common Core is going to be used to bring in leftism. I think those are the two fears.
Yeah, I honestly don't think that's what these kids are thinking, though.
Not at all.
But I will say this, though. You know, we're trying to increase standards. Outside of more privatization in school, there's really not a lot you can do to hold the public schools accountable. Increasing the standards somehow, whether it's through testing, new evaluation system, I think is one of the best ways you can possibly do that. But let's think about it this way. The left is always complaining that the right doesn't want to just tweak Obamacare and fix it, as opposed to repealing it. Well, what's the difference with this issue? I think we have something that may work, and that there's evidence that it is working to some degree. However, the left wants to scrap the whole thing. They don't want to fix it. They don't want to reduce it. Maybe if there are too many tests. I've asked teachers last year when I was campaigning, I asked parents who happen to be teachers about this very issue. Well, why don't we just
tweak the system? Why don't we just reduce the number of standardized tests that we're giving right now? No answer. They want to repeal the whole thing. It's some sort of, I think the problem is that teachers are now forced to be a little bit more accountable. I'm acknowledging that the system's not perfect, needs to be tweaked, but they don't want to be held accountable. They want to go back to the old system.
Here's part of the thing, though. I mean, I think that people understand that we don't we don't educate our kids as well as we would like in New Mexico. And it is, in a sense, a test like this coming in is a reflection of failure. I mean, I think people see it that way. We can't teach our kids. We want to have an internal reformation. We want to teach kids on our own. We want to build up the school system and have better results. And these tests that are coming in from outside are just a reflection of failure. And I think people are bothered by that.
Well, let's be honest. We are failing in the state. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're always in the bottom three or four given in any given category in education. We are failing. And let's look at a big picture here. The big picture is that people have been tested since the beginning of education.
Since the beginning of time.
I mean, what is the deal with testing? All of a sudden, we can't test. As long as you're testing to what the kids are supposed to
here's the problem. People know that a monkey or a rat can be trained to respond to stimuli. They want their kids to be able to sit down and pass any test, not this one test. And maybe that's not realistic.
So you're saying this is the test that they're supposed to take today or yesterday is the ultimate test? The big test? I thought there were multiple tests.
I think what people are reacting to is they want their kids to sit down and be able to pass any test, not be trained to pass one test, because that doesn't mean they have knowledge. We've got a phone call here. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Aaron Kelly.
Aaron, what's up?
Well, I think the problem is not the testing. It's that there's not ever any consequences to failing a test. I think social promotion is way out of hand.
Hey, Aaron, how common is social promotion in your experience?
Well, I think it's quite prevalent in my experience from what I've seen. Like I told you, I went back to school recently, and it's been 2 years, but the first year I was there, I already have a degree from a previous profession. And I would be willing to say that in one of my classes where we were asked to write some scientific reports that we had to do, probably 7 out of 10 failed. In college, they couldn't write a coherent thought.
That's tragic.
It was tragic, and it was I found it very disheartening. I was actually pretty sad about it, to tell you the truth. The TA was the master student, they teach these labs, and he came out before he handed the test back, and he said, 7 out of 10 of you aren't writing at the 8th grade level. You need to go up to the writing lab and, spend 3 days, learn how to write a paper. And these were people in college, and they couldn't write. And, now we have people in the 3rd grade, they're not willing to hold anybody back because we'll damage their psyche. Well, what's their psyche going to be like at 20 when they can't write a paper?
Aaron, hold on 1 second. I'll put you on a hold. It's Kelly. And, Aaron, okay, we got another call. So sum it up for us. What's your reaction to these tests or the protests?
Well, I think these national tests, is this a national test or just a state test?
Neil, what do you know?
From what I understand, it's just the state test, but I'm not sure.
No, it's
that.
A state test, I think, but it's part of a national movement towards making sure that we're testing all the kids in America, and that's the Common Core,
Well, I'll tell you one thing I've heard from my kids, one's a senior and one's a freshman, is that the tests don't have anything to do with what they're being taught.
Yeah, and that's the worry here, and I do have another call, but the worry is you're being trained to take one test that you don't even benefit from the knowledge of being able to pass it because it's specific, it's not general knowledge that can be used.
Well, they need to create a test that tests what's being taught each year.
Yeah.
Not just this general knowledge test that somebody in some company or in some organization determined to be the end-all, know-all of knowledge. I mean, yeah. Let's teach them the math, let's teach them the history, and now let's test them
on it. Let's do it.
But if they fail, then there's got to be something to that.
Aaron, I got to go to the next caller. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connor Show. Who's this?
It's Patty Riley.
Patty, how's it going? What's up, briefly?
Okay, briefly. My dad was a teacher here back in the 60s. He was a math teacher. He was very good. He would sit down, help his students. They were very good. The thing is, they started dumbing down education in 1960. And they've ramped it up ever since. It's gotten worse. I'm part of the school system here. It took me 25 years to get through college. I couldn't read in the sixth grade. My parents found out and live it. Okay? It's ridiculous. Most of my graduating class, 1983, couldn't read to get into college.
Mothership to Patty. Are you saying you personally did not know how to read until sixth grade, or you were not up to the level?
I was not up to the level of reading.
I see.
And I had to spend every day with a tutor after school that year to get up to speed. Okay.
Well,
and another thing about this is the teacher unions, they need to go by the wayside. My father would not join one of those. He's viably against it because it's a national common core, whatever. Child left behind. Yeah, we're left behind. We're 50 years behind.
Holy cow.
And we need to get it up to speed.
Holy cow.
I love everybody. I love everybody out there. Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks,
bye.
Matt. Thanks. Have a great day. All right, folks. I've got a little lost highway for you. Hank Williams, one of his more haunting songs. Hank Williams was going through some sort of a religious search at the end of his life. He had an alter ego. And, so I believe Lost Highway was part of that. I'm here with Neil Hooks. Neil Hooks may be one of the most articulate and intelligent people you'll meet in Dona Ana County, which may not be a very high standard, but we've got him in the studio. We'll be right back at 719-523-1450 to call in on a KOBE, the Kelly O'Connell Show.
I think it's one of the prettiest ones I've ever recorded. Boys, if you will, a little tune called The Lost Highway.
I'm a rolling stone, all alone and lost. For a life of sin, I have paid the cost. When I pass by, there goes another boy down the lost highway.
Kelly here, and I just found out that the gay evangelist Bill McCamley was trying to pass a song, and he was laughed out of the roundhouse. But I was wondering, was it the village people, Neil? I mean, was it?
Yeah, no comment on that other than to say that his song that he wanted to pass for to be the state song of New Mexico didn't pass. I read the article and remember reading something about the song. It was a kid's song. It was cute, but it's what politicians do when they really don't have a lot to offer.
One thing I noticed about the Swami of Salami is that he offers things that are out of the pop culture, and it makes him seem like he's cutting edge. He doesn't appear to have any depth to his approach to people. You know, if you have politicians that don't really care about other people, but they try to take advantage of trends, they're going to create more chaos than they solve.
Look, you just hit the nail on the head with regard to every leftist liberal politician in this country, though.
But we want to remember, and there's listeners of this audience, but they're out there. There's a lot of Democrats that care about the country, but for whatever reason, they're in that party. They support some of the stuff. Some of the stuff they turn away from, they may be a little bit embarrassed by the president. What we need is a Reagan movement to get these people across the aisle, you know? And we got another call. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Tony.
Tony, what's up?
Hey, man, I just want to weigh in on this education issue.
Absolutely.
You know, I just retired from teaching in May because I got tired of all the political BS that goes on.
Give us,
you know, the GOP's agenda is to destroy the union.
Tony, let me ask you something. What are some of the indignities that you had to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, this whole issue of social promotion. You know, people don't realize how many students teachers want to fail, but administrators have them pass the students on so that they don't look bad. Also, parents can sign waivers to keep their, have their kids promoted to the next grade, no matter how poorly they read, write, or do math. This is not about teachers socially promoting students on a whim. You have no idea.
Okay.
If you're not in the field,
Tony, listen.
What teacher, the
Tony,
anguish they go through.
Tony, then what I hear you saying is even the teachers are getting victimized in this whole thing.
You know, and that's the whole deal. Is this is supposed to be a community effort, education. Yet everybody's coming down on these teachers as if every teacher in education is an incompetent twit. And you don't have no idea how much they anguish. I've seen teachers in tears over people failing, students failing. When are we going to hold others responsible? Kids are never held accountable for their learning, and neither are their parents.
Tony, Neil had something to say to you.
Hey, Tony, yeah, I concur with you, and anybody who says it is the teacher's fault is probably not...
An ignoramus.
Yeah, it's probably not really tuned into what's going on. It's not the teacher's fault. It's the system's fault, and the system right now is completely and utterly run by the federal government, and it is monopolized by teachers' unions. The teachers' unions does not hold anyone accountable. If you're working in a system like that, over time, it's going to degrade the quality, degrade the product. And that's exactly what's happened.
With that said, one of the major problems with education is the fact that educators are not allowed to make decisions. It's politicians making the decisions based on their agendas.
Yeah, so let's
and one of the big
it,
things teachers want to do
Tony.
That they never get the opportunity
Tony.
To discuss.
Mother,
is,
mothership to Tony here. Neil, what were you saying?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I mean, so let's make it so that the teachers and the parents and the students and the administrators are all more accountable. And that's what we're trying to do in the state.
Tony, hold on. It's Kelly. I'll come right back to you. Yeah, Tony, go ahead.
Okay. See, this is the whole deal. You're saying hold them accountable. That doesn't change the system. We need to get kids in their grade appropriate, level appropriate classes. We cannot have kids who are at an A level in, let's say, a ninth grade level in reading in seventh grade.
Agreed.
In a class with kids who read at a third grade level.
Agreed. We got another call here, but Tony, anything else?
Nah, because I'll go on all day. Have a good day.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Thanks for the call. The Kelly Connor Show. Who's this?
This is Aaron again, Ken Kelly.
Round two, Aaron.
One thing that's being left out of the conversation is parents.
Is what?
Parents. I go to, I go to these parent conferences, and there's three of us. Out of 30 kids, three parents show up. And you know what? It's the three parents who don't need to be there. Their kids are all getting good grades. So until we put more of it on parents and take all this pressure off, it used to be on parents. We've gotten in this habit of turning everything over to the school.
That's so true, Aaron. We got to take a little break here, but good points. Thanks for the second call. Folks, do you think it's appropriate for YMCA to be the state fight song? That's what the gay evangelist Bill McCamley may have been trying. I don't know the name of the song. I'm just guessing. Neil seems baffled here. I'm guessing it's YMCA or In the Navy. Those would be the songs that would come to mind with Bill McCamley with his raging enthusiasm for everything, like trendy and he's a huge proponent of gay marriage, gay adoption, gay villages. I think that's another of his ideas. Here we go. Speaking of obsessed, Jim Gaffigan weddings. Speaking of weddings, Kelly O'Connor, 523-1450. We got the brilliant Neil Hooks here. The brilliant and modest is only you're only shortcoming Neil. You're too modest.
You You know, I'm not often speechless, Kelly.
He's speechless, folks. Let's take advantage of this and play a little comedy. We'll be right back.
Sometimes I feel like I'm trying to get fat. Last night I was eating a pint of ice cream, and I finished it because I'm American. All right? I took off the lid and I threw it away because I'm not a quitter, everyone. And because I care about the environment. I was conserving energy by not refreezing it. You're welcome. Of course, it was at night. You ever eat ice cream during the day? You're like, what, are we 6 years old? Did we just get our tonsils out? Why are there people around me? Shouldn't I be alone watching Lifetime? Those hoarders, those are the ones with the problem. I was eating a pint of ice cream in sweatpants like a man. My wife came in the room. She was like, Jim, are you going to eat an entire pint of ice cream by yourself? I was like, hopefully. Unless you selfishly want a bite. Jim, you have a 9-year-old daughter. Don't you want to be at her wedding? Not really. No. Wait, is there going to be ice cream at her wedding? Because if you promise, I still don't want to go. How would attending a wedding, why would that be an incentive? It's like, don't you die in 18 years. There's an awkward party you have to pay for. And we need you to write a check. Now, I understand weddings are an important event where we spend a lot of money so that the bride can pretend to be a princess and marry her prince and live happily ever after because magic exists. And we're a bunch of weirdos. Weddings are kind of weird. I mean, what's the logic? It's like, well, we love each other. Why don't we pretend we have a kingdom? We'll invite your parents' friends and my parents' friends, and we'll have a banquet. And the two kingdoms shall come together as one. And we can start our married life with a total fantasy before we go on a completely unjustified vacation. It's strange, right? I mean, weddings started off as these crude medieval ceremonies where women, daughters, were exchanged as property. Yet over the course of centuries, they got worse. That's why people cry at weddings. I can't believe we're still wasting money on this. Whenever I see someone crying at a wedding, I would say, don't worry, it probably won't work out.
Kelly here, and we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
It's me, Kelly, Mike.
Oh, all right, Mike, what's
the
up?
Right, Kelly, the righteous Gentile.
I hey, am Kelly. Or you are?
Well, if you're a Zionist, you are.
Anyway, hey, Mike, yeah, go ahead.
I have a question. There's a commercial that comes on, and they talk about educating the whole child.
Yeah.
Is that a part of Common Core? I mean, there's a Catholic school that advertises it, and I notice now they pulled that. They don't say whole child at the end of their commercial.
Maybe they didn't want to be confused with Whole Foods. I don't know. I've never heard the educating the whole child, but it does make you wonder a little bit, I guess, you know. Nobody would go educating a partial child, but anyway.
Is it a part of the, your guest is very articulate, and I just wondered if you might know if that's a part of Common Core.
Educating the whole child, what's your opinion?
You know, I'm unfamiliar with it. I haven't heard, so I really can't comment. Sorry about that, Mike.
There's a
woman that comes on the radio on the weekend. Her name is Sorbo.
The advertisements at the bus stop. Maybe that's a problem.
You know, Kelly?
Right here, my friend, listening.
There's a woman.
This is Kelly. I'll be right back.
The last name?
What's that?
Her name is Sorbo.
All right, so Sorbo.
Well, she was talking about Common Core, and she said it was she had a guest on, and they said it was educating the whole child. It's like a buzzword.
Well, Mike, why don't you do some research on us and get back to us on it, what it means?
I'll Google it.
Thank you. Have a good day. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Thomas.
Tomas, what's up?
locally here, the advertisement that he's referring to, if I'm not mistaken, has to do with some of the Catholic schools or church-related schools that are talking about educating the child mind, body, and spirit. That's what they're using the word whole or holistic as. And that's a pretty common term, actually.
What is common?
Holistic.
Yeah. Of course. So but does that mean that it has a religious element in the training?
That is precisely correct. It's being used in the medical field as well.
All right. Anything else, Thomas?
Nope, just maybe a point of clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So, so we're here with Neil Hooks. Neil, I got to ask you, we'd like a little bit of light shown onto minimum wage. What is minimum wage? How does you, since you have a kind of an economics insight background, how should we, what would be the most enlightened way to look at minimum wage?
Well, the argument for minimum wage is that there is not enough money flowing to the lower class, the lower unskilled class of workers. And what do we do about that? Well, the government solution is always, what can the government do about it? Because the government is so good at making equal results. Right? So why not have the government force employers to hand over more money for their employees, and the employees can be richer, and now we don't have much of an income gap. Right?
Now, here is the fear. If you don't have a minimum wage, people will be forced to accept a penny an hour. You know, that's the fear is that the level of payment will be so low that even the most frugal persons living in their parents' basement couldn't survive.
Yeah, so let me dispel some myths. On the left, and some people on the right really don't quite understand the economics of this either. So the problem is with that argument, by the way, with somebody's only going to get a penny, is competition. Go ahead.
We got a phone call. Thanks for the call. The Kelly Carter Show. Who's this?
Hey, this is John, your tow truck driving buddy.
What's up, man?
I know how to get rid of the need for a minimum wage. All we have to do is shrink the size of the federal government down to what it's actually supposed to be and cut back taxes drastically. Problem solved.
Neil?
John, you're absolutely right, but let me explain the nuts and bolts of why you're right, okay? Well, the reason you're right is because employers, they create jobs and they give people raises and give their employees more money when they have more capital to work with. So one of the ways to increase the capital of an employer is by reducing his economic burden from the government through taxes, lower taxes, and lower regulations, correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Which is exactly what you're saying. So that's one way. The other way is somehow to increase demand for that. Let's just use one company in particular, a mythical company. I want to give my employees more money. In a competitive market, an employer cannot just willy-nilly give an employee $15 an hour arbitrarily because he's going to compete himself right out of business. So what does he need to give his employees more money and to make them more wealthier? Is to increase demand for their product, to increase wealth overall, to expand. Part of it is by having more capital outlay to use to expand the product line, to create more jobs, to give employees raises, to promote them, et cetera. But the other way is simply through that increased demand of his company, he'll be able to pay more money to his employee. Now, how do you increase the demand? You become more competitive. You increase your niche. You get more capital outlay that the government is taking from you, and you use that to innovate and to become more competitive and to grow and to create wealth and expand. So the answer is not the government forcing. When the government forces the transfer of money from the employer to the employee with outside of a market supply and demand component, all you're doing is transferring money, and there is zero net income.
Exactly. And, you know, and then a smaller part of the responsibility lies on the employee. You know, I tell people in my industry all the time, you know, they complain about their pay. And I tell them, look, make yourself indispensable to the company. your pay rate becomes a your pay increase becomes effective when you do. You know, if they're better employees, people are going to try and keep them.
I agree. I tell people all the time that it's not a low minimum wage that keeps people from being able to raise their families. It's a lack of opportunity and a lack of skills that prevents them from raising their family.
Well, it's also become a lack of a work ethic.
John,
we've become very much an entitlement.
John, we've got to go. I've got to take a break. Anything else?
No, that's it, man. Keep up the good work. I hope they keep you on, Kelly.
Oh, thanks a lot, John. I really appreciate it. Folks, they're still looking for input. They're looking for input on all the stations. They were grateful for the people that called in. And we will. Here's a little more Lost Highway. Lost Highway, by the way, was written by Leon Payne. He was a blind singer-songwriter, and he was hitchhiking from California, trying to get back to Alba, Texas to visit his lost mother. He couldn't get a ride. The Salvation Army brought him back, and he wrote Lost Highway on the way. And it was from the Luke the Drifter days of Hank Williams. And anyway, we'll be right back. 746-523-1450, 805-6180 to text. And we'll be right back. Kelly O'Connell Show, KOBE.
Cards and a jug of wine. And a woman's lies makes a life like mine. For the day we met, I went astray. I started rolling down that lost highway.
Hey, Kelly here, and we're going to listen to Neil Hooks' ideas on minimum wage, how to maybe solve it, but I just want to remind you, the president has said through his spokesman, he is interested in unilateral tax increases, and don't forget that is what caused the Revolutionary War, taxes without any input from the people. It's absolutely crazy. Do you really think the president is making the country better by such actions? Neil, I see you shaking your head there.
Yeah, I think he hurts Hillary Clinton's campaign every single time he comes out with a new presidential edict. So I say bring it on. Let him tax us. Let him try to tax us unilaterally. I think it's just going to piss people off. As far as the minimum wage is concerned, so you know, in a nutshell, if you force an employer to pay an employee above what the market is dictating, then all you're doing is transferring money from one hand to the next. No economic increase. You're actually taking that capital formation from the employer that he uses to give raises to and to expand and create jobs. So the only person you're helping, according to the studies and the surveys as well, is the only person you're hurting that is are the poor people who, ironically, that's what the minimum wage is supposed to help. So this is what I propose. For the minimum wage, I say the wave is coming. I think the vast majority of people don't understand the economics behind the minimum wage. They think it actually helps. They think it's good. They think it's a benevolent thing to do. I don't think we're going to be able to prevent from not increasing the minimum wage on a state level. So this is what I propose. I say we compromise with the minimum wage. At the same time, work to get a right-to-work bill passed in our session.
Right to work
use
means
the
you
two
don't
together.
Right to work means that you don't have to join a union to be employed. But let me ask you this. Do you really think that the minimum wage does more harm than good? I mean, people are going to hear that and say, you want me to go work at McDonald's for 50 cents or 25 cents an hour, don't you? You're rich. You're a capitalist. You don't care about the poor. What's the response to that?
Well, my answer, first of all, your first question is yes, it is bad. It does zero good whatsoever. The answer to the second question is competition. Competition will simply not allow somebody, an employer, to pay. McDonald's cannot pay their employees 50 cents an hour. The employees will leave. They'll go to Burger King and they'll get $7 an hour.
50 cents an hour plus a dollar hamburger.
Yeah, the market has a magical way. I know liberals don't understand this concept, but the market, the invisible hand, where people are making free will choices in the marketplace, takes care of all that stuff. The government doesn't have to force it. When the government forces it, they just make a mess of things. Now, as far as the right to work is concerned and the minimum wage, tie those things together. Liberals, give me the right to work, and I'll give you a reasonable increase in the minimum wage, maybe even tied to the CPI.
CPI? The heck is that?
The Consumer Price Index. So basically based on inflation as well. So, I'm not saying that's the answer, but that's one of the things we do to compromise on this issue.
Hardball question. If we didn't have a minimum wage, would poor workers, the lowest strata of workers, actually make more money, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
As a very minimum, they would have more jobs available to them. And when there are more jobs available with the amount of work, this is supply and demand concept. When we have more jobs available for the workers who are, more jobs available for the workers who are in existence, you have more demand for that labor. And with the increased demand, you have increased wages. Yes, absolutely.
Interesting. All right, take one last break here. Kelly O'Connell, a little more Lost Highway. Hank Williams, he was on a Lost Highway, if anybody was. Died at the age of 29. What a genius. We'll be right back. 7:53 Kelly O'Connell Show with Neil Hooks. Well, folks, just kind of concluding here with Neil Hooks, and we can cure the economy's problems in part if we have more realistic policy, right?
Yeah, none of these things in and of themselves is a panacea, but you start chipping away at the bureaucracy and the government control and the regulations and the high taxes, and sooner or later your economy is going to start moving.
And what else? I guess we're going to have to do another show for me to ask you what else we can do to help cure the problems in the state. But it's heartbreaking to, we heard at the meeting last night, it's a bad state, according to a lot of businesses, to come into. They just don't have a lot of advantages.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. This right to work thing is so important. It's one of the pieces of the puzzle that makes us more competitive and allures more companies into our state. And with more companies, more jobs available, we can pay higher wages and everybody's happier.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Neil. It was very enlightening.
My pleasure. I would love to introduce the Kelly Man for some more righteous tunes on his keyboard.
Oh my gosh.
Ebony and Ivory.
I wish I could play that song. Actually, I don't play any Michael Jackson. I hope you don't hold that against me. Speaking of new, and I wonder what was the song that the gay evangelist Bill McCamley wanted the kids to sing. Was it YMCA? Was it in the Navy? Was it Lola by the Kinks? Was it?
I think in honor of Bill McCamley, you should play one of those songs in closing.
All right. I can't. All right. All right. New song, according to, if I can find it here in time, the new song that Bill McCamley wanted the kids to learn and to, I really hope this works, folks. Bill McCamley's New Mexico, here, kids, enjoy.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, yourself off the